Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ Volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners. Care of Nature Now at kptz.org.
Hello, this is Mary Robson bringing this week's Nature Now. Here we are on the edge of winter solstice when the moments of light seem scarce and we fold ourselves into the darkness. Of course, we will start with a mystery sound. All I can say about this is it's a four-footed animal. And some observations. I'll be helped by our ever-helpful Charlie Fleischman. Starting with sky events. Winter solstice is Thursday, December 21st. It occurs throughout the Northern Hemisphere when the shortest day happens. And if you were living in Auckland, New Zealand, it would be the longest day. The solstice is listed for 8:48 a.m. locally. Give or take a few seconds. The light will be increasing. It will be 25 seconds longer on Christmas Day. 25 seconds? That's long enough for a child to rip open a package. So, and look for meteor showers, December 23rd and 24th, if the sky clears. The Ursid shower is named so because the meteors seem to emerge from the area around Ursa Minor. Last week's Geminid meteor shower had a particularly bright and beautiful display, events 1 to 2 per minute, 100 an hour. People who saw it really commented that it was fine. The Ursids will be much quieter with only 10 possible meteor observations per hour.
Bird versus drone, seen at Canyon Park in Bothell last week. At the east end of the retention ponds is a company that manufactures drones. They test the drones in a parking lot that is elevated above the retention ponds some 30 to 50 feet. As many as 5 spotted towhees, along with some smaller birds, were engaged in mobbing behavior as the hawk-like drones are tested in the area, reported by Steve Cravel in the University of Washington Tweeters blog.
There's no fooling a bird. They said if it's flying and it's in my area, I better get at it.
Soil temperature still moderate. WSU reports that the roots of trees and shrubs will continue to grow until soil temperatures drop below 40 degrees in the fall. Measured with a soil thermometer, soil was 47 degrees near Discovery Bay on December 18th. This was on a day with no wind. At sea level here, we've had no cold enough duration to freeze ground. Soil and root activity will continue until the slow cooling of winter sets in.
And finally, plants as a light source. Observers are used to animals and fungal organisms that can emit light. Plants to date have not. MIT engineers have taken a first step toward making plants shine by embedding specialized nanoparticles into the leaves of a watercress plant. They reported that the plants gave off a dim light for nearly 4 hours. They did not specify whether this is a one-time effort by the watercress, and oddly enough, the plant lit a copy of Milton's Paradise Lost, a strangely ironic choice for the study. Our vision is to make a plant that will function as a desk lamp. The light is ultimately powered by the energy metabolism of the plant itself. Out in the future, trees might become self-powered streetlights. This is from Michael Strano, a chemical engineer who is the senior author of this study. It's in its very, very beginning. Today we will bring you bird discussion. Not exactly specific birds, but how a person who has come to this area helps out learning and working with the local societies. Gary Bullock, who is with us today, and his wife Lee moved to Squim from Anchorage. He was a battalion chief for the Anchorage Fire Department before retiring. Birds were part of his Alaska life and part of your life even earlier than that, right?
I've been interested in birds since I was a child. My grandfather took me out hiking in the woods and fishing and looking at birds, and so I've been doing it a long time.
Let's hear it for grandparents. The ones that can be around can be really helpful. Well, we started talking a little bit about your favorite birds, but I wanted to say more about what you do with the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society. Gary helps lead the Wednesday 8:30 a.m. bird walks, and we'll be talking a little more about those, supports local birders, builds bird houses, and essentially lives with birds as a very big part of his volunteer life. You have some favorite birds you want to talk about?
Well, there's a lot of favorites, but a couple off the top of my head, American Kestrel, which used to be called a sparrowhawk.
Uh-huh.
It's our smallest falcon and our most common falcon. And I grew up around them and used to see them along the farm fields, just hovering over the fields looking for mice. Just a beautiful bird with chestnut and blues and grays and just an
amazing
bird.
About what are they? Are they the size of? Are they smaller than a robin?
They're a little larger than a robin.
And powerful the way all bird predators are. And you mentioned ravens.
Common raven, they're just an amazing bird as far as being intelligent, being all over the country, all over North America. They have 15 to 30 different categories of vocalizations. They have quite sophisticated talking that they do amongst
them. I've heard a couple of them that almost sound strangely like they're ringing a bell. I couldn't make the sound myself. I've tried, but it's kind of liquid and a single note.
Yes.
It's astonishing. And because you were living in Alaska, you have seen ravens in terrible winter conditions in Prudhoe Bay, right?
Yes. They have a Christmas bird count there in Prudhoe Bay. Mm-hmm. And when they do that, they have one species on the list, and that's the common raven that is there all year.
Everything else has migrated from the situation.
Yes.
Right. Do you have an idea of the range of lower temperatures that these birds can manage?
Well, obviously 30, 40 below zero.
I'm on the radio. You can't see me shaking my head. I was just being amazed. I know there's a book by Bernd Heinrich, Ravens in Winter, which he studied in Vermont, but the conditions in Prudhoe Bay have got to be worse.
Yeah, and I think the only reason the ravens are there is because humans are there, and there's a chance of finding food as far as garbage and whatever around the pump stations and the human habitation.
But they also then have a metabolism that lets them survive at those temperatures. That's what surprises me. Put ravens in your pocket as one of the most durable and bright birds we've got. And the other one that you mentioned as a favorite is the sandhill crane, and I think of them as being a migrator through the central of the country, through Nebraska and along the Platte River, but you said they also exist in Washington?
Yeah, they're mostly migrants in western Washington here. The ones we see them spring and fall as they migrate through from further north, British Columbia, Yukon, Alaska, but the main flow is down the central flyway that you recall.
Given that they show up now and then in Washington State, have you had a chance to see any here?
Well, we lived here for 5.5 years now, and it wasn't until September of this year that I saw one in Washington, and that was really neat to see a couple fly in.
Where were you?
I was down at Dungeness Landing in Squim, looking for another bird, rare bird that was supposed to be there, and it was just about dark, and three sandhill cranes came flying in and calling and landed in the marsh and started doing their little dance and I think settled in for the night.
We talked a little bit about the Christmas bird count, which in this area is now underway and will continue for the next 2 weeks until December 30th. The purpose of this is to find out what birds are around just for winter, or how does that work?
It's citizen science. It's been a tradition that's gone on since 1900, so this will be the 118th year.
Wow.
Started out with early Audubon Society member wanting to do something else than the standard practice of going out at Christmas and shooting as many birds and animals as you could find. He says, let's go out and count birds instead, because they were worried about declines in some of the populations,
well,
even in 1900.
Well, especially because they had seen the passenger pigeon disappear by then.
Yes.
Almost completely. And, the skies were so dark with passenger pigeons, you couldn't see through them. And they were gone. So that's a really inspiring way to have the Christmas bird count start. There will be details on the local Audubon websites if you feel a yen to join a Christmas bird count.
Yes, by the time this is broadcast, three of the four local counts will already have taken place.
Okay.
But there will still be one in Seattle on the 30th, and also North Kitsap will have one.
On the 30th.
On the 30th, and also Port Angeles.
We'll get back to you in January with some of the results of what happened on the Christmas bird count. One of the things that we also talked about was the projects that you're involved in, making nest boxes for various kinds of birds, including the bluebird area where people are looking to see how many bluebirds do we really have and could we get more. How did you get started making birdhouses, and what kind of a recipe do you have? Do you have to improvise? How do you get your nest box planned?
I first got my nest box plans out of books. There was one by the, I think, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, and they had nest box plans. And since then, there's been Audubon books with plans. Just find ones that work and that are not just decorative. It's important to have the right size box. Most birds do not need a perch on a nest box. That just allows predators a handhold, basically, to get into the box.
So one of the first reasons for putting up a nest box for a native bird or even a migrating bird is to keep predators from getting in. What are some of the major predators that would be standing around waiting for egg breakfasts?
Around here, it would be starlings and house sparrows. House sparrows and starlings are both invasive species that were introduced in the United States from Europe, and they've both pretty much decimated all the cavity nesters as far as taking over the nesting cavities in natural trees, forcing the native songbirds out, sometimes taking the eggs and also killing the young.
Killing the babies when they're hatched, for instance, the hatchlings?
They'll kill the hatchlings or they'll break the eggs and throw them out and use the nest box themselves.
Most of the time, people who are talking about the problems of songbirds talk about habitat loss. They don't talk about predation as much. And that's a major problem around here?
It goes hand in hand with habitat loss as far as there's not as many natural cavities in trees, because when a tree dies, we often cut it down so it doesn't fall down on somebody for liability reasons.
Right.
If there's not sufficient cavities, they don't have a place to nest, and they're in competition with the house sparrows and starlings.
Starlings are pretty big birds. Don't they need a fairly large aperture to get in?
They can get in a standard size hole that's like 1.25 inches that you would use for a swallow, and so can house sparrows. Lately, we've come up with a smaller size, a oval shape or elliptical hole that's 7/8 inch wide and 2 inches long.
Uh-huh.
That allows swallows in, tree swallows, violet-green swallows, but the house sparrows and starlings cannot get into those.
It must be sort of an experimental thing to protect the swallows. Is it mainly the violet-green ones that are in need of protection?
Well, it's both the cavity nesting species, the violet-green and the tree swallows. We have both of them here. There are more violet-green than tree swallows.
Otherwise, we see cliff swallows, or what people sometimes call barn swallows, which make mud nests and seem to be okay as far as survival is concerned.
They nest under bridges and sometimes in trees and along cliffs.
And under the edges of houses sometimes.
Yes. Those type of nests aren't predated by starlings or sparrows, house sparrows.
And they aren't because the adult is able to be there and fight off what's going on? Or?
They really aren't interested in those nests, in those nesting spots. They're more interested in a cavity nest.
Okay, so they just want to be able to take over an existing nest, and the side effect might be a little bit of something to eat in terms of eggs and babies. Boy. There are a couple of other birds that might take over nests. I'm a fan of red-winged blackbirds, but I understand that they can get troublesome with cavity nesting birds.
Not that I'm aware of.
Oh, okay.
Blackbirds usually nest in a cattail marsh.
Right.
Steller's jays can take young out of bird nests, either a regular bird nest mm-hmm. or out of a nest box. If
I think
the hole
a Steller's
is
jay could probably take the hat right off the top of your head and nest in your hair. They're so aggressive.
They're more interested in finding food as far as eggs or young.
In this case, then, you're going on making nest boxes, some for the bluebird study. And are those out at the Three Crabs area? Or I'm not sure where they exist.
Most of the bluebird study nest boxes, I think, are on the Miller Peninsula.
Okay.
Towards Diamond Point. Mm-hmm. That just seems to there's be a better area for them.
There's a county park out there, too, that yes. I think is relatively new from what I can tell. But it would be a case of almost intuiting where a bluebird might be when we have a very few of them here.
There's a group out of Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society that's working on that, and they are doing surveys to locate pairs of bluebirds. And when they find a nesting pair, they'll set up a nest box in that area.
Okay.
They're keeping it fairly quiet right now as far as locations, because they don't want too much activity.
People standing around with scopes and binoculars looking at the bluebirds. It's a striking bird, and it's being essentially assisted and protected almost all the way across the country, isn't it?
There's been programs for 30, 40 years to mm-hmm. encourage bluebird nesting because of the loss of tree cavities and the barrows and the starlings, which do the same with the bluebirds.
So one of the take-home messages is leave your snags up when a tree comes down, if you can. And I was wondering about how important is returning to the same place to a bird. Some birds return to the same area when they migrate, some don't. Do you know anything about how that works? Because that might mean that your nest boxes would get used year after year.
That does happen. Birds do come back to the same nest box or nest shelf or area, and sometimes the young come back to where they were hatched and fledged.
Wow. We get that experience sometimes with hummingbirds who will return to a feeder, but you're not sure it's the same bird, actually, but they come anyway. If you're birding in Clallam County versus Jefferson County, is it different?
It can be different. There are different species and different habitats. Jefferson County, Port Townsend area, has more salt water, actually, and cliffs and nesting areas in salt water than Clallam County does. So you might see different types of birds there. I know there's a lot more rhinoceros auklets between here and Whidbey on the ferry than you would see out of Sequim if you were out on a boat out of Sequim.
Interesting. It just means they've found better places to nest, perhaps.
That more meet their criteria.
If you're starting to bird walk and you want to go on one of the Wednesday morning bird watches, what will you get for help? I mean, you just show up as a newbie.
You'll be met with smiles and greetings, and we all introduce ourselves. And if you don't have binoculars, we have binoculars you can borrow, and you'll be birding with a group and get a chance to learn birds with other people and point out the characteristics and things to look for and where to look. So it's a lot easier if you're starting out to join a group for a day or every week or whatever to go out and find birds. We usually have two or three spotting scopes along on the Wednesday bird walk, and we set them up so people can see the birds we're looking at and get a good look at them.
That's great. Any other suggestions about learning? I think some people are just a little bit like, ooh, this is too hard. I don't know where to go.
You just got to start small. Just listen around you, slow down, and go out with others. And that'll really, I think, open your eyes to what's out there. And try and learn a couple birds at a time, the common ones, and get to understand their calls and plumages and where you'd find them. And just you can build from there.
Do you list your birds?
I keep a life list of all the birds I've seen, and I keep a county list every year.
Starting again at the beginning of the year and saying, okay, what did I see this year?
Yes.
Well, it's almost the end of the year. Do you know what your bird count is?
I'm at 217 species in Clallam County, and I'd like to get to 220, but it's getting pretty close to the end of the year. I don't know if I will.
We need something exotic to fly in, like a parrot or who knows. Just as a kind of wind-up, there are a lot of apps at this point about bird watching and bird sounds. But if you're just beginning and that's unfamiliar, a good bird guide will help, right? Like a book.
That's what I'd recommend. Start out with a bird book, a bird guide, either National Geographic or Peterson's or Sibley. Mm-hmm. You can leaf back and forth through the pages and compare different birds. Mm-hmm. The beginning of the bird books have great glossaries that show you what to look for on a bird, the anatomy of a bird, what feathers are where.
Silhouettes.
And then it groups them into families. And if you actually read through the bird book instead of just looking through the pages, you'll learn about the different types of birds that are similar to one another and the same family, and be able to, as you go through, learn where you might find them.
That's great. Thank you so much for bringing us more bird news. We will look forward to doing this again, and I appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you, Mary.
Finally, the mystery sound. Many of you probably realized this is an elk. I was not able to use reindeer. The screech is produced by the elk using two different sound areas, a lower ordinary bugle from the lungs and a whistle from the lips, nostrils, and palate. It's a distress sound or an attention call. This reminds me of something like the music made by some humans, so-called throat singers, such as the Tuvan, who can sing two notes at once. The Roosevelt elk, handsome and sturdy, the largest of the elk species, is endemic to the Olympic Peninsula rainforest areas with old-growth forest and into Alaska, where they were introduced on Kodiak Island, possibly for hunting. I have seen a large group on a field near the Ho River. These herbivores benefit forests by clearing underbrush and allowing space for other animals. It is estimated that nearly 10 million elk lived in North America prior to 1500. This was reduced to less than 100,000 by 1907. And the first name suggested for what is now Olympic National Park was to be Elk National Park, as it was intended to be a reserve for dwindling elk herds. This comes from a publication called Oregon Wild. And finally, events. This is a very busy week with many events, but very few of them are natural history related. On Friday, December 22nd, there is a bird walk, the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society at Dungeness Bridge from 9:30 to 12:30. Check with them for more details. That's it for Nature Now for the third week of December. Thanks to Charlie Fleischman for engineering our words and sounds. We hope you have enjoyed our program of authentic, live, and eclectic reports. Nature Now airs at noon on Wednesdays, with repeats here on KPTZ, Thursdays at 5 p.m., and Saturdays at 12:30 p.m. Podcasts are also available on the website www.kptz.org.
Nature Now is produced by Nan Evans and edited by Charlie Fleischman.
Today's closing music is Bluebird, performed by Doug Paisley.
Song of the bluebird, buried in the dust. Did you once hear how she cried? Though the years may have passed her, in tears and in laughter, there's a song that she left behind.
My father's own father, he sailed through the air, and he found enemies in the sky. But for all that surrounds us, that anchors and binds us, there's a song that we carry inside. Oh, wild is the wind in the night. Oh, wild am I. I'll wait until the day begins and